A Thursday edition, a little bit later in the program, Ian Scher will be here. He writes for CNET, and actually CNET sent him to Sicily over the summer because he was writing a piece. They're doing a series on smart cities, and so he drew, well, that's a nice big fetch draw, I think, to spend some time in Sicily to look at what they're doing there. So we'll talk to Ian about that coming up. Elise Glink will stop by a little bit later to look at some of the jobs numbers and to look at how people who lost their jobs in 2009-11 through the recession, where they are now, and if they've able to get back to where they wanted to be, the sorts of career positions that they were hoping for. Chris Matthews writes about jobs as well for Axios, writes about a lot of different things involving business, and he joins us on a phone line now, first time on the program. Chris, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And so one of the things I'm a big fan now of Axios. It's a great way. Mike Allen was on the show, Jim VandeHei, not too long ago, and I kind of start my day with Mike's digest of 10 different items. And you've been on it a number of times. So one of the things you wrote just recently that struck me was about manufacturing jobs. You know, the president talked about they're going to bring jobs back to this country. We've lost a lot of them, but you sort of uncovered some research that shows that people are more likely to quit one of those manufacturing jobs than they are to be laid off from one. Explain that for me.
That's right. So if you look at the Labor Department provides us data on the percentage of workers who are fired from a type of job and those who leave on their own volition. And we're seeing of late that the share of workers who are leaving manufacturing is rising pretty quickly, while the percentage that are being fired is staying pretty flat.
So does that mean that there are manufacturing jobs positions sort of wanting in this country?
I think what it means is that, you know, right now we have a very tight labor market. There's a low unemployment rate. And these manufacturing jobs aren't the manufacturing jobs of the 60s and 70s that were really solidly middle class, supported by union backing. A lot of these jobs are somewhat low paid. They're very right. difficult on the body, and so these aren't the most desirable jobs in the country.
It's interesting.
So move up from them. Yeah.
So in a way, we're sort of chasing history when we're trying to chase these jobs. They may not be what we're thinking they were altogether.
I think that's right. We've lost a ton of manufacturing jobs, but the vast majority of us work in service sectors, and that's ultimately where most people want to go because you can make more money there.
You know, you said you mentioned unions. You know, when I was talking about this upstairs in the newsroom earlier today, the guy I was talking with said, well, this maybe is a function of unions losing their sway. I mean, plus or minus, good or bad, but the fact is the unions maybe protected those workers and improved those wages in a way that the absence of unions aren't doing now.
That's correct. I mean, there's nothing fundamental about manufacturing that makes it a good job. One reason why they became good jobs is because there was a lot of union density that demanded higher wages, better working conditions, and that sort of thing.
Well, we don't want to hear that because Foxconn is coming just over the border here in Wisconsin, and they're promising us billions and billions and billions of dollars, Chris.
Yes. Well, I mean, any job, if you don't have a job, is a good job. So we should keep that in perspective.
Yeah, I don't know if those will be union jobs either. I'm sure that's been reported. I just haven't seen it. Another thing you wrote about, which fascinates me, I work for, well, currently it's Tribune Media. It will be changing soon, I think. But it was the Tribune Company when I started. I still qualify for a pension. So I'm hoping one day that I will get a fixed pension, you know, not a full retirement benefit, but a partial one. And there's a piece you wrote about how a lot of big companies now are actually saving money on the pensions that they need to pay out, not because of cuts in benefits, but because, and this I didn't realize, because we're dying earlier, or is our life expectancy shortening, or it's not increasing at the rate that they had expected, or what's behind that number?
It's mostly that life expectancy is not increasing the way we expected. Throughout American history, life expectancy had increased at a steady rate, and now we're seeing it flatten out. And actually, for a certain demographic, the white working class, we're seeing slight declines in the life expectancy, which does lower costs for both corporations and the government in terms of Social Security and Medicaid.
And we're talking about billions of dollars when you add it all together?
Yeah, it's several billion that some of the biggest companies so far have announced to shareholders that they're saving from this.
Because the working class is dying earlier. Well, that's not altogether a good thing, I guess.
It's, It's not a great thing, but this is one interesting effect of it.
Are you right about the fact that some of these are deaths of despair in a way? And I just wonder if you think the numbers of that are big enough to really have an impact on this national figure.
Well, we're seeing, suicide is an increasing cause of death. It's one of the top 10. Drug addiction is another major cause of death. So these things do add up.
And so that might be because of the economic downturn in 2009 and after, that could actually be resulting in lower pension costs for some of the big business around the country. It's kind of a weird, twisted way to think of it.
It is twisted, but it's an important effect.
Christopher Matthews writes for Axios.com. If you haven't checked out Axios, I'm sort of on a bandwagon for you guys. I think it's a great site. I love what you're doing. And like I said, it's one of the ways I start my day. So nice to finally talk to you. I hope we can do it again.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks a lot.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. We'll round out this first half hour of the program with Bill Geiger, who is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill Geiger are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Mr. Geiger, welcome back. I haven't seen you in a while.
Good to see you, sir.
I think I was off during your last visit, maybe.
It's been a few days.
So we were just talking with Christopher Matthews about, it's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it, that big businesses are paying less in pensions because, sadly, unexpectedly, we're sort of dying sooner. But I mentioned the fact that I have a little pension. Right. Fewer and fewer of us do have pensions, and that's kind of where you come in, right? Because we can't rely on pensions anymore.
Well, you can if you create your own. Let me tell you, the happiest people that I ever see coming in my office are couples with a large pension because they know how it's going to work when they retire. They know how they're going to pay their bills. They know how they're going to travel and everything. If you're not fortunate enough to have a pension, there are strategies for taking your 401k or an IRA and actually creating your own pension.
That's one of the things that we were going to talk to today, is to sort of build a stress-free retirement.
Right.
When I read about that, I'm assuming that's what you're talking about, the idea that you know that you've got money coming out.
It is. After doing this for 30 years, I can tell you the thing that makes a retirement stress-free is knowing how you're going to pay your bills.
Well, yeah.
Right? You can sleep at night. We had a 60-year-old couple come into our office that want to retire in 7 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
No pension, and Social Security absolutely was not going to cut it. The guy took his 401k plan, which was $800,000, and we created a plan for him. So in 7 years, he and his wife are going to have $70,000 a year of their own private pension, if you will. You throw Social Security on top of that, they've got a six-figure income for the rest of their life. They're happy campers.
All right, back up and tell me about that again then. So what you're saying is you're putting the money in vehicles where you're creating income.
An income stream.
And a known income.
That's dependable, that's sustainable, and these folks are going to be right around $70,000, maybe a little bit more in 7 years.
Right.
And you put that together with their Social Security. How would you like to know right now today that when you retire, you're going to have a six-figure income for life?
I could go for that, Bill.
I could go for that.
Can you make
that happen?
Is that
stress-free?
Can we do that before you leave?
We've got you on the calendar for next week, sir.
Do I have to do anything?
Show up at the office.
So can people do this with their 401k?
Yeah, they can do it with their 401k. They can do it with an IRA. And if you think about it, when was the last time you pulled money out of your IRA?
I haven't.
Never.
Yeah. Right.
Because it's for retirement, right? Well, it's got to be someplace for retirement. So if that someplace can create dependable, sustainable income for you. Oh, let me follow up on this couple.
Sure.
$70,000 a year. By the time they're 85 years old, they will have pulled out of this plan $1.5 million, and they'll still have a portfolio worth around $1.4
million. Nice.
That works out on a lot of different levels.
And, I mean, part of it's really hard work, saving the money,
yeah.
But part of it is knowing where to put it and how to put it in places.
Yeah, and with everything going on in the world today, if you're late 50s, early 60s, you really should sit down and start figuring out how to do this stuff.
Right. So but let me ask you that again, one more question.
Sure.
Because and we go back and forth on this, or I ask often, but how do we know when it's okay for us to quit working? When is the time?
When you know you have the income, not assets, but the income necessary to pay your bills.
So it's not about the nest egg. It's about the monthly check coming
it's
from the nest
egg. It's
about
the monthly check coming in. And I know you're going to talk about this in a moment, but we're going to have to do something special for your listeners today. The first five callers who have at least $500,000 saved for retirement, we're going to sit down with them personally and help them put together a complete custom retirement plan for themselves on a complimentary basis.
Excellent. Bill Geiger, thanks for coming by.
My pleasure.
We'll see you again in a couple weeks, I hope. Summer will be over.
We'll see you then.
I hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand or on Facebook. I've got a couple of Facebook pages. There's Steve Bertrand Travel or a Steve Bertrand Public page. Speaking of Steve Bertrand Travel, I'm texting today with Pete McMurray because he's leading a group of WGN listeners a little bit later this afternoon as they head to Ireland. They're going to take a trip to Ireland, the Republic and Northern Ireland, and actually see Van Morrison in concert. It's a really cool thing. He does a few shows a year at this hotel, about 350-seat ballroom, and about, I think it's 30 or 40 WGN listeners are going to be in the crowd coming up a little bit later next week. Ian Schur just was in Europe, although I don't think he ran into Van Morrison. Ian, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. So Ian's got a baby at home, what, maybe about a year old now? Is that right?
Yes, he's actually 15 months now.
15 months, okay. So a great age. Every baby, every child is a wonderful child. But when you have a kid maybe less than two, it's good to get a road trip too once in a while. And so that's how Ian was able to finagle a trip to Sicily to do part of this series of their road trip 2017 looking at smart cities. And they focused on now Sicily surprises me a little bit, Ian, because I was mentioning earlier, I think of Barcelona or I think of, mm-hmm. Chicago to an extent as well. I don't know that Sicily has the infrastructure to sort of create this smart city, but you found some interesting things there. What did you see?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. You're absolutely right to think that, if you were to list the techiest places on the planet, you would probably list like New York, San Francisco, Chicago, London. Sicily would never even be in your list. And what's really fascinating is that when I went there, they actually have a very ambitious program going on. They're, in fact, one of the most advanced smart city projects I've seen. And what's really interesting is they did this all on a shoestring budget. They did it under $100,000. And what they've been able to do is tie together stuff like starting to create prototypes of trash bins that tell the city to automatically, when they get too full, to come over and pick them up. They are doing stuff like pothole detection. They even have stuff where if you point your phone at a with the camera on at an old monument, it'll tell you all the history of it. And so all of this really fascinating stuff about what they've been able to do, and again, be able to do this on a shoestring and pull ahead really in the smart city race ahead of many other more advanced cities.
Well, are they able to do it because they're smaller and they don't, and maybe the existing infrastructure needed updating? I mean, what is it that's allowed them to do it? I know there's a university in town that was instrumental in all of
right.
it.
So between the two cities that I profiled, there's a million people. So they're not that small.
Okay.
Really what made it possible is that the politics of it worked. I spoke to over a dozen people, including a lot of city managers, and I even spoke with Rahm Emanuel, your mayor.
Right.
And one of the things that came up was that this conversation about how politics really slows down a lot of these advancements. And so a lot of the places like Louisville and Cincinnati and San Diego said that the reason that they've been able to do this really is that they've been able to push forward because the city doesn't get in their way, right? The city government is, it's a couple of people. It's not an entire board of people. There's not a lot of politics involved in trying these things out. And the other thing is that Italy is willing to put in 13 million euros into tech projects right now. They're really on a tear about it. And so the money is there as well to make that happen. And those two things together really made it easy. One last thing I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, go for it.
Software and sensors are readily available now. Ever since the iPhone came out, sensors are super cheap to buy now. And the software out there is really advanced. And you can mix and match this stuff really easy. A lot of these sensors are $100 or so. So it's not that hard to build. You just need the political will and the effort really to make it happen.
I thought it was interesting. One of the things they did, they're concerned about privacy. So they have sensors in the airport that don't take pictures of the lines to show you how long the lines are. They measure the heat from the lines.
Exactly, and you get a gray outline instead. We have a really great video of it on CNET. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that some of the experts I spoke to said a lot of these smart city projects are doing a lot of cool techie stuff, but they're not thinking about privacy, and it's like this massive problem just waiting to happen.
Are you talking to?
So they, you know, it's interesting. Well, yeah.
No, I was just go ahead, finish your thought, Ian. I'm sorry.
Well, it's okay. So it's interesting that these people are saying, okay, well, we're going to try and think about this stuff ahead of time. And we're going to try and, you know, let's use a thermal camera instead of a normal camera so you can't pick up people's faces and all this stuff. And it shows a difference between the scrappy, small Italian city versus a massive city like San Francisco or Chicago.
And the idea is the more heat being released, the longer the line, the longer the wait. Okay, so you said you talked to Mayor Emanuel. Okay. Where does Chicago fit into all of this, and what did you pick up from the mayor?
So what's really interesting, and we're actually going to have a bigger story on it later in this week, what's really interesting is that, you know, that Chicago is doing a lot of kind of more specific programs. So one of them that I thought was cool is that they're actually mapping the underground. So I don't know if you know, the city has like more than 30 companies and utilities they have to deal with pipes under your ground.
Yeah.
And they have really poor documentation of it. And it takes up to 30 days for the city to be able to go through all of the maps and everything to see whether or not when they dig, whether they're going to hit a power line or something. And so this this group that they have in Chicago called UI Labs, which is over on the Gull Island there, they are actually they're helping to map the entire area. What they do is that they take a video of the construction site once they're done putting in a pipe, and then they digitize it, and they're able to create kind of a sim city of Chicago. It's super cool. So we're going to have a lot more on that on CNET, but it's really interesting just kind of how, especially in Chicago, but in the United States as well, they're doing these very specific programs to make sure that they kind of have an immediate impact instead of these very broad ideas like what Italy's doing.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And I'll look for that to check it out later on CNET.com. A couple other questions while I've got you. Do you mind?
Yeah.
All right. I can't wait for self-driving cars, but I'm a little worried about this report you guys did that showed that they can be fooled by, you know, and town I grew up in, you'd have a stop sign and someone would be funny, like then they'd put a politician's bumper sticker under it, "Stop Jim Thompson" or something to that effect.
Right.
But you guys did
a piece. Stop in the name of love.
Stop in the name of love. or stop before I call you again. And but
exactly.
But they're, with this technology, I guess I thought that the cars would drive all together by GPS. I didn't think that they would actually be reading the road signs. You guys write that they will be reading road signs, and there will be ways for people to doctor those road signs would wreak havoc.
It's really scary. Yeah. So the University of Washington did this study where they basically tried to figure out how much do they have to obstruct a road sign to confuse a self-driving car. And we have a photo of it on CNET. It's not much. I mean, it's like a couple of banned stickers and you're in trouble.
Do they have to know where
really
to put...
interesting thing to me.
But Ian, do they have to know... the bad guys have to know where to put the stickers?
To some degree, yes. You know, they found a specific pattern that messes with it, but here's the other thing to keep in mind. Everyone's self-driving technology is different right now. What Ford has is different from Tesla, which is different from Uber, which is different from Google. And so what's going to be problematic is that we don't know how each one of these will be confused. So it brings up a lot of interesting questions. You know, this is one of the reasons that self-driving technology is not out there right now, is that there's still dangers in it. And what I think is probably going to end up happening, I don't know for sure, is that people like Uber and Google are going to have to map out where every stop sign is. Because even as human beings, if someone comes over and knocks over the stop sign, I don't see it. I could get in an accident.
Well,
so they're going to have to do something to make sure that this isn't a problem.
Okay, am I the last one to realize, I mean, does this make me sound really dumb? I didn't think the cars would be reading the signs at all. I thought the signs could actually go away, that the cars would be... you know, that the GPS data would include stop sign or yield signs or speed limit signs. I didn't realize the cars would be relying on those things.
I think some of them do. I don't know which ones do and don't. But I imagine in the future that they're going to have to take away that, you know, they're going to have to take that away. But the cars do read all sorts of signs all the time. They're reading stuff partially because the, you know, signs change a lot, right? And they change quicker than the maps are updated. And the other thing is that the cars do have cameras to make sure that they're looking out for, like, pets in the road and people who suddenly jump out in the middle of the street, which you and I, I'm sure, have dealt with plenty. And so they need to make sure that they're looking around anyway. And so reading the signs is part of that process.
Ian,
but you're right.
I was going to say, Ian, it's been years since I've jumped out into the middle of the street, but thanks for bringing it up.
Well, no, I was saying dealing with people who do it. But yeah, maybe you have. But I think that eventually, you know, the signs will need to go away and that this stuff will need to be digitally created. But at the moment, it seems like it's all mix and match, which is part of the reason that this is a concerning study.
That's Ian Schur. He writes for CNET.com. You can check out his road trip series about Sicily and more is coming up later this week. Ian, great to talk to you again. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Elise Glink is on a phone line. You know Elise, of course. She's with us on most Thursdays, the publishers of ThinkLink.com, CEO of Best Money Moves, an HR app for businesses that helps employers measure their employees' financial stress and then figure out ways to deal with that. You can read more about that at bestmoneymoves.com. Elise Glink, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, Steve. It's nice to be here, and hello from San Francisco.
I was going to say, we just talked to Ian Schur, who's out in Silicon Valley somewhere with CNET, and now you're in San Francisco. What's going on in San Francisco?
Oh, there's all kinds of interesting conferences that are going on here. I'm running around town talking to housing economists who are in for a big conference, real estate technology conference.
I want to talk jobs with you a little bit, and you shared an email with me, which got you to thinking and then me to thinking as well. You know, people are finding work again. They're back at work. The number of job openings was very high for June, even indicating that there are jobs that people aren't qualified for some of the jobs that are out there. But there are a lot of us who've had to sort of shift and reconfigure to regain employment, and it's not always exactly where we want to be.
Right. It's interesting that we're seeing people get jobs, but the jobs they're getting pay less than they had before. And we saw this right after the recession as well. And you would hope that 10 years out that you would finally see people getting jobs that actually pay more and have more benefits. But that doesn't always seem to be the case. While we have some part of the economy where we are seeing, you know, people earning more money and getting better benefits, there's a large portion of the economy that's not doing that, but the jobs numbers are counting part-time jobs and full-time jobs as being employed, and so the number is very low for unemployment at the moment.
You know, Christopher Matthews was on from Axios at the top of the show, and one of the pieces he wrote, we didn't have time to get to it, was that, and I think this was just what you would know, I guess, with the last jobs report, that we're just getting now to where we were before the economic downturn in 2009 as far as people having jobs. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Again, though, they're not all full-time jobs paying full-time benefits.
Right.
Or if they are full-time jobs, they're paying a little bit less. But we are seeing the number of unemployed being right about where it was before the last recession. And there are some concerns that either that number is not really accurate or it is accurate and there's no real room now. So maybe incomes will have to go up.
Well, we keep hearing that. I mean, I've been hearing that for years. When do you think it's going to happen?
I know there are a lot of people out there who say not soon enough. What you're seeing for over the last year, you saw incomes rise about 2.5%. So just over the rate of inflation, which is good because it means that workers are gaining ground. But I think that some of that was a push from the $15 an hour wages that we saw being put into the marketplace.
Right.
And so in cities where they've done that, I think we have seen wages rise substantially in some cases. But not enough.
All right, so this is where we get into the discussion of whether those $15 minimum wages work, right?
Right. I think there was a somewhat discredited survey that went out that said, no, people who are earning $15 an hour, that just means that employers are laying them off. And there were some economists saying, no, that's not really the right way to read the data. I think it's too soon to know. But the truth is that there are a lot of people who are making $16, $17, and $18 an hour, and really that doesn't translate into so much money either, particularly if you're doing an overnight shift or you've got childcare expenses that are a big drag on it.
And I don't want to keep asking you questions that I had for my first guest, but another thing that we talked about with Christopher was that, and this is fascinating to me, the number of people quitting manufacturing jobs is greater than the number of people being laid off from a manufacturing job. So in other words, you're more likely to leave than you are to lose your job, which means that maybe those jobs aren't as attractive as they used to be or that we pretend to be now.
Well, there have been a number of stories over the last couple of weeks about manufacturing companies that are actually buying or leasing robots in order to do some line jobs that they just can't find people to do. They just don't have enough people to do these sort of line manufacturing jobs. I think that that's something to watch. We've seen it with hamburger flipping. I know of some technology where they replaced dishwashers in hotels and restaurants, people who wash dishes with technology.
But what's interesting that what you're saying is that the machines are coming in because the people aren't there, not that the people are being pushed out because the machines are coming in.
Correct. They just can't find the people to do those particular jobs, and so, or at least not with any regularity and not at a price that makes economic sense for the business. So you're seeing the machines start to come in to take some of these, you know, pieces of jobs, really. They're not even a full job.
Right.
And that's something to continue to watch. But again, they're not finding the 100 people that they need. So they're getting, you know, a piece of technology to fill that spot.
That is Elise Glink. Elise, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it. Enjoy your time in San Fran. Cubs just left. They lost 2 out of 3. I hope you win more than that.